I'm in the business of wanting to resurrect that triumphant beast in you.
Welcome to The Boundless Body, the podcast with the somatic doctor interviewing innovative thinkers about their perspectives relating to the arts and sciences of therapy.
Expansion and contraction, that is the primary binary inside the construction of your body plan.
Dr. B is a voyager in trauma resolution who brings compassion and humor to the adventure of healing.
You study science enough and the bottom drops out and you're just like, oh.
Enchanting elements of science, philosophy, and art. Discover the boundless body here on this podcast.
Back to the mystery.
Okay, welcome to the boundless body, Aldrich.
Happy to be here, Brian.
Yeah. So I'm going to just start with a little introduction here. Dr. Aldrich Chan is a neuropsychologist, author of the award-winning book, Reassembling Models of Reality. And this is the book that I use in my class with students. It's the assigned text. I really love it. And that was published in the Interpersonal Neurobiology series by Norton. Aldrich is also the founder of the Center for Neuropsychology and Consciousness, and has a practice in Miami, Florida, that provides neuropsychological and psychological services. In addition to his practice, he is an adjunct professor for the doctoral and master's programs at Pepperdine. So welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
So one of the things that I really loved about you, Aldrich, is that you don't just focus on neurobiology and the neurobiology of the default mode network. So you're kind of pioneer. Yeah, in my estimation, you took Raichel's work on the default mode network and really made it available to clinicians. And so we'll talk about the default mode network today in triple network theory. And one of the things that I really like about you is that you weave in philosophical traditions. You take this wonderful neurobiological research, interpersonal neurobiology, the biology of attachment, and then you bring philosophical angles in. Mm-hmm. And you really kind of bring us into, I guess we could say, the art of perception. You like that phrase, the art of perception?
That's good to me.
Let's roll with that, the art of perception. Maybe we could call the podcast, this episode, the art of perception. Something like that. Well, the arts and the sciences. So that's one of the things. There's this big cleft between the humanities and the sciences. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that you brought in Whitehead in your book. And we have a mutual love for Whitehead, and drew from the philosophical traditions to help augment and frame the wonderful science that you bring forward. So well done with Reassembling Models of Reality. It's a great,
thank you.
Text.
Yeah. I'll just add in here that I think it's very important these days to approach these things from an interdisciplinary perspective, namely because, you know, science, as productive and amazing as it has been, it's also limited. And philosophy, and of course, neuroscience and psychology, when you put those all together, it gives us a greater picture. But even those three all together is not going to give us a full picture. So, you know, we try and fill in the gaps as we can.
Yeah. Interdisciplinary research is kind of appreciated in this age of specialization. Mm. Yeah. So I really want to celebrate that. You know, some people look at my history with research and they say, why would you want to study embryology? And how could that possibly have anything to do with psychology? And I'm like, why wouldn't I study embryology? Mm-hmm. Like if I'm interested in somatics and the body, why wouldn't I be interested in how the body plan is constructed? Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Whitehead was a genius for this stuff, you know, interdisciplinary, going into the sciences and taking the best and leaving the rest, and then weaving it with sociology, you know, considering that the cells of our body and the brain, for example, are like a sociology of cells, that there's tensions within the body plan and so on. There's tensions inside of culture. There's tensions inside family. There's tensions in the attachment relationship, and everything is struck through with tension. And I think that his thinking about that the universe itself is an organism is just mind-blowing.
Yeah. It was definitely a giant leap forward and very prescient of him to come up with his model. You know, I think it's important, you know, if we're moving into this direction already, but when I bring in the philosophical aspect, I like existentialism a lot, actually, but also, you know, this metaphysical aspect, I think, is important because everyone is so married to particular metaphysical paradigms without even knowing that they are. So people, for example, who are complete reductionist materialists, you know, believe that that's synonymous with science, and that is just a complete error because none of them is just an interpretive framework for the evidence that is accrued through time. And science itself doesn't have that interpretive angle. And there are many interpretive frameworks out there that function quite well with the totality of what we know about science. And Whitehead's model is a great example of one of them.
And you just got this amazing signed text, original text from Whitehead, which is cool. Yeah, on that bookshelf, maybe behind you there is this text with his signature. Yeah.
It's not behind me here. It's in a safer location.
We can't. Okay.
It's religion in the making. It's a first edition signed copy. Thank you so much, Jason Brown, for gifting me that copy. I was just floored when I received it in the mail. But yeah, Whitehead's he's a giant.
Yeah, this, you know, I'm thinking to myself, you know, it's often either too much science or too much metaphysics. You know what I mean? And I like this idea of interdisciplinary research as a way to bridge and retain mobility between these great traditions, the humanities, the philosophies, the sciences, and then clinical practice, which, you know, both of us are clinicians. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and how these great traditions inform clinical practice as well in neurobiologically informed imagery work, for example, which I believe we'll be exploring today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's this idea from the work of George Northoff. He calls it concept fact iterative. Basically, it's this continual iteration of concepts and comparing them to facts and creating a dialogue between the two. Now, we might also add practice to the mix. So we explore the concepts, we compare them with the facts of the concepts, and also with our practice. And we continue in this sort of cycle that allows us to spiral upwards, hopefully.
Can you say that phrase again? Iterative what?
So he calls it concept fact iterative.
Interesting. It's a phrase that indicates mobility, you know, in your cycling. You talk about the concept of cycling, which has some roots in some of Gendlin's focusing work, where you're cycling through image, you're cycling through sensation in the body, and you're cycling also through meaning-making processes. So the whole thing is quite mobile. So I like these frameworks where there's a retainment of mobility where you cycle through and everything just is, it's a living process of interpersonal perception. I guess that's another one, right? Interpersonal perception. And the intersubjective field you talk about. So just so much great stuff in your work. I'd like to continue. I'd really like to explore this triple network theory, which involves the default mode network. And maybe we can continue with that and talk about, like, what is this default mode network stuff? And why is knowing about the default mode network of the brain, why is it useful for clinical practice or useful for understanding perception?
Okay. Yeah. I think that's a nice place to start. So I guess I'll start off by saying that the default mode network, first of all, it's a network of brain regions, right? When we usually study the brain and you're starting it off, you've learned part by part. That's not how the brain functions. In real time, there are multiple regions of your brain that are active simultaneously, and they form networks. And one of these networks is your resting state network. And I put quotations because your brain is never really resting, but it's your default mode network. You sort of default to it. Now, what's kind of interesting about I'm going to call it the DMN for short. What's so interesting about the GMN is that earlier on in the mid-1900s, towards moving upward towards the invention of the EEG and so forth, it was just considered noise. And people would use it as a as a control group and say, it's messy noise, doesn't really matter much. And it wasn't until later on in the 2000s that it actually became something of a serious topic, right? Especially with, you already mentioned, with Raichel's work, who really brought it to the forefront. Now, what's interesting to me is that the DMN being your default mode network is very much reflective of your internal world. And it relates to things like introspection, your social cognition, your self-reflection, or if you're mentally time traveling, in M.Dell Tolving's words, if you are projecting yourself to a future scenario to simulate something that you may be moving towards, or to go back into the past and retrieve a memory and maybe learn something from something you've learned from history or whatnot. Anyways, you put all these together and you get this internal dimension of experience. And it's funny to me that was just considered noise from a neural perspective in the earlier days, but you know, nowadays it's being taken more seriously. So I don't know, I guess I'm pushing this forward because there's a sort of parallel process, right? Where psychology now is being taken a little more seriously, especially as it is related to the neuroscience and such. Now, the DMN doesn't function alone. It's only one network. There are several networks. And even in this triple network theory, there are many more networks beyond the triple network. But the triple network, of course, is very important to know about. So of course, so firstly, we have this internal world, we could say. Then we have a network called the salience network. And implied by the name salience, you know, when something alarming is happening around you, it's something salient happening around you, it will change your, it will point your attention in a particular direction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And something salient can be happening outside you, something salient can be happening inside you. And so that network is really about toggling in between the default network and an outer focused network, a goal-directed network that we call the central executive network, the CEN. And so there you have the three different networks and how they sort of all interact with each other. Now, one thing that's important also to mention about these networks, however, is the fact that when the default mode network is active, it inhibits or silences the central executive network. And when the central executive network is active, it will silence the default mode network in the average brain, we can say. But when we start exploring different conditions, you start seeing that relationship isn't so delineated and it can be a little more messy and there becomes a lack of integration. And I guess I'll pause there for now to see what thoughts you might have.
Yeah. So the CEN, the Central Executive Network, was originally called and is still called the Task Positive Network. So that when we're on task, like you and I are on task, we're doing this interview, you know, we're talking, we're on task. And the original articulation of the default mode network is like they're a reciprocal tension system, almost like the autonomic nervous system, where you have the gas sympathetic system and then the brakes parasympathetic system, almost like a kind of piston or a reciprocal system, where default mode network goes down when we're on task. Okay. When we're kind of daydreaming, which you say in the book, about 50% of the time we're actually daydreaming on a daily basis, which is quite interesting. Yeah.
Well, that research was interesting. Go on.
Yeah. Well, and I love this image in your book. It really concretizes the information, the scientific information about these networks. And in the book, you have this wonderful image of a sailing ship.
Mm-hmm.
And in the sailing ship, and this is an image for how these networks interact. You have this sailing ship and many sailors on the ship that represent the different components of the triple networks. And as you said, you know, there's many networks. It's not the three networks isn't the whole show, but this is a great articulation, a kind of update of the old reptilian brain, triune brain model. It's kind of like the elaboration of that. So on this ship, you have a mast.
Yep.
And up at the top of the mast is a sailor with a big floodlight.
Yep.
Representing the salience network.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the direction of attention. And then in the front of the ship, you have these sailors that are engaged in the task of fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And those, and so when the salience network, that top of the ship, the floodlight there, when the salience network, because that's the salience network, when we're on task, the beam goes towards the sailors that are on task. They're doing their thing with fish hooks or whatever, whatever they're doing, those fisher people.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the back of the ship, which represents the default mode network, and it's very, and this actually maps onto the brain as well, because the core node of the default mode network is in the back of the skull, actually, posterior cingulate cortex, right?
Well, also the medial prefrontal cortex, and that's in the front.
The orbitofrontal, the seat of mental time travel and all that stuff, right? There's this, major hub in the back of the brain. I like to focus on that actually, because there's so much attention that's brought to the front of the brain,
mm-hmm.
as a kind of really evolved place of the brain. And I like to just highlight the fact that the core hub of the default mode network is towards the back of the brain, actually. Mm-hmm. So, you got these sailors huddled at the back of the ship representing the default mode network. And those sailors, it's a group of sailors, they're looking at each other, but one sailor is looking towards the front of the ship and one sailor is looking backwards, which is a wonderful image for the mental time travel component. One is looking forward and projecting and predicting the future, and one is looking backwards to kind of like, remember the past and fantasize about the past and sometimes perseverate about the past.
Cool.
The rest of the sailors are engaged, they're looking at each other, and that's indicating the social component, mm-hmm. of the default mode network, which has a lot of overlap with the mirror neuron system.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of social mirroring processes happening there. So when the floodlight of the salience network is going back, 50% of the day or whatever, and the beam is on the default mode network, then we're doing that thing where we're daydreaming, we're fantasizing, we're projecting, we're doing mental time travel into the future, into the past.
If you enjoy the content, please subscribe, like us, and share. Dr. B offers a dynamic blend of therapeutic maps, modalities to help you catalyze, stabilize, and thrive. Book a session or free consultation at www.somaticdoctor.com.
And then you talk about, in your dissertation, you talk about the dynamics of trauma. And I'm wondering if you can comment on, like, using this image of the ship, what happens when trauma and PTSD comes onto the scene?
Yeah. So there's a whole dissertation for that, but let me see how I'll jump right to the conclusion. And that is basically the fact that when the default mode network is active, I usually say, right, where I've mentioned earlier on already that usually the central executive network is silent, the salience network is silent, so there's just one network that's active. But in this case with trauma, what we find is that there's salience network intrusions with the DMN being simultaneously active. And so we might think about symptoms of hyperarousal, let's say, or people who are, extremely attentive to danger that might be happening around. And then on the other side, when the central executive network is active, the individual is focused on a goal-directed task, what they find is there's actually default mode network intrusions. And so now we find that they're no longer inhibiting each other, but your internal world, or the contents of your internal world, is now intruding upon your capacity to function in your everyday life, which also makes sense with the symptoms that we tend to find with PTSD. So that would be the sort of disrupted sort of network interaction that's happening.
So, and you don't want, if you're working with fish hooks, if working with fish hooks is your task,
okay.
You don't want the default mode now. You don't want to be daydreaming at that moment. Like, it's probably a pretty bad idea. I'm imagining that, that might be happening right there in River City in Miami, right? Some fisher person is out there, maybe this morning or something like that, and they have some PTSD, and then they have an intrusion of their daydreaming while they're on task, which is really bad news sometimes.
Right. So if we were to elaborate on the metaphor, right, we could imagine, for example, the person who looks backwards, maybe running to the front of the deck and is whispering things into the ear of one of the fishermen, telling them that the war is still on, or telling them that they're about to be abused or hit or whatnot. And the person with the rod, you know, who knows what they might do as a result. And so that can be a way we.
And let's do some, yeah, that's great. And let's do a little bit more work with the salience network and make it more applicable to the folks that are interested in somatic psychology. So I like to say that the salience network is kind of like the heart of somatic practice, because the core structure involved in the salience network is the insula, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the insula does a lot of this stuff called interoception.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're tracking the sensations in the body and, you know, what do you feel right now in your belly? What do you feel right now in your chest? And not, and of course, a lot of people in clinical practice, when you ask them first off, like, what are you noticing? What are you sensing in your body? They'll say abstractions. They'll say, I'm feeling compassion or something. And I like to say, oh, well, compassion sounds like a good idea, but what does it feel like?
Yeah, people are so dissociated almost from their bodies just in general, that it's interesting that even when you ask them to go into it, it's almost a strange request for them, right? Where their mind goes back to that land of abstraction, and you sort of have to correct them in some sense, like, well, that's a feeling or that's a nice thought. But, you know, what is the experience in your body, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so that salience network, it lights up, that insula lights up when we're tracking the sensation. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm feeling these sensations in my belly. You know, it's some cross between fear and excitement that we're being recorded and so on. There's these visceral sensations in my gut. But if I have PTSD, those sensations can become intrusive and intrude upon either the default mode network or the task network, the central executive network. So I'm seeing that as kind of like the sailor at the top with the floodlight representing the salience network is kind of like all over the place, or even drops off of the mast of the ship or something like that.
Mm. Mm.
Any other images there or metaphors there for what metaphor might you use for PTSD and the salience with the floodlight?
Well, I mean, I would follow that, that imagery that you already provided. We could talk about how the light itself becomes fragmented or cracked, and the light starts dispersing in different ways that it shouldn't, or it's malfunctioning. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, what's going on is that the core responsibility of the person on the mast, you know, in directing and highlighting what to focus on and what not to focus on becomes dysregulated. And when that happens, your whole world flips around, because attention is one of the most important, you know, factors that is going to change the way the world comes to you and in the way that your world is experienced. So,
yeah. So, we can continue the discussion in terms of clinical practice, right? Because under the phrase intrusive sensation, so that some folks with PTSD, when we direct that flashlight beam of awareness towards sensation, that the sensation in the body itself can become intrusive. And I think this is a really important point, because in the somatics community, there's almost this assumption that embodiment is always going to be good.
Mm.
And that's not really the case, because some people, when we direct that flashlight towards the sensory body, it'll become extraordinarily fragmented. Mm. And the sailor, it's almost like the sailor that's looking back towards the past, climbs up the mast of the ship and shatters the light or something like that. So I think this is a really important point, because we can't just assume that the body's and its sensory reality is going to be stabilizing for everybody.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point that you're highlighting, Brian. This idea, firstly, that there are specific good or bad associations with certain areas of the body or certain parts of the brain. like similar thing with people, when you think about the frontal lobes, they think of executive functioning, they think it's a positive thing, but it can also be for negative things, like in a sense of manipulation and such. Same thing with stress. People think of stress as a bad thing, but we know that mild to moderate levels of stress can be very, very beneficial. And I'm very happy that you're bringing this point up.
Yeah, abstraction can just run haywire, right? So there's this term, this wonderful term that Whitehead threw down. He calls it the tragedy of misplaced concreteness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just think it's just such an incredible term, right? Because that's another thing that can happen. It can be this kind of smuggling in of an abstraction with kind of the clothes of the concrete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I gave this example of compassion. Like, what are you feeling? I'm feeling compassion. Sounds like a great idea. It sounds concrete, but like, what's the warp and woof? What's the, you know, what's the experience of it?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I think that fallacy, that tragedy is something that lots of people these days fall into, right? This idea that we're constantly becoming is forgotten, that we're constantly changing. And actually, one of the things that I've made it a habit of myself is that every time a client comes in from session one to session two, to three to four, I always try and start off by completely clearing any of my preconceived notions about what's going on and trying to see them as a new person every single time that they come in.
Yeah. Thanks for correcting that. It's not the tragedy of misplaced concreteness. It's the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. And I've translated it in my mind as something that is actually really dramatic in our species. It's dramatically tragic. Mm-hmm. I think I've translated it for that reason. It's,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think in my experience, it's much more than a fallacy. It's a horrible tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
This broken bridge between the abstract and the concrete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it creates atrocities, essentially, people confusing stories for reality.
Yeah. And it also creates this stagnation of movement, right? This sort of self-imposed blockade where you don't allow yourself to even change or allow your mind to flow with the nature of your body.
Yeah. The other fallacy that I think is existent in the somatics community is this idea somehow that the sensory experience and the stuff that's done in the salience network where we're tracking sensation is actually in the here and now, when actually it's not. The speeds that we're talking about in terms of neural processing are extraordinary. So I'd like to read actually a quote from Reassembling Models of Reality here. That's talking about the speeds at play that we're talking about in the brain. So here we go. Modern neuroscience exposes the misplaced concreteness of be here now by revealing that the conscious mind, which experiences, perceives, and labels sensations in the body, lags behind real time by approximately 350 milliseconds. And during this interval of massive speed in the nervous system, the perceptual data is run through loops of feedback filters, correcting errors modeled from the past, and feed forward filters, projecting, predicting, and interpreting the future. So let's talk more about feedback and feed forward filters.
Sure. So feedback loops involve basically, it's like trial and error, right? So something happens, we try something out and it doesn't work out. There's conflict monitoring, for example, happening in the anterior cingulate cortex. And basically there's a feedback loop there that kicks in to correct for the error that happens. Now the feed forward loops are different because those are actually based off of templates that already exist, things that we've already learned about. So there are things that we are anticipating might happen. And as a result, these anticipations, these expectations, which are incorporated into the predictive systems of our brain, are sending signals in order to correct for anticipated errors.
Nice one. Yeah, there's a whole model called the predictive simulation model of the brain, which is essentially this feed forward model. And, you know, just kind of like almost like the blind spot in the brain, there's a filling in process. Mm-hmm. And this stuff, and the whole point of all this stuff is to challenge this idea that there's really even a here and now. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's what we're tracking in our bodies, if we're doing that, it has already been run through a bunch of filters mm-hmm. that are assembling our model of reality. And that's based on our attachment history that's attached, you know, the experiences that we've had in the past, and that gets predicted into the future, which is now. Mm-hmm. And then, so it's really interesting, right? So I like to think about, and you do say in the book that the default mode network is a bit of a waking dream. Mm-hmm. A kind of our kind of default state of how we hallucinate reality.
Yeah, I mean that's definitely true. I mean, there are so many levels to that. Also, that idea, that the fact that the reality that we're experiencing is potentially nowhere near what actually exists outside of us, and so much of what we see is a perceptual hallucination. Some might say it's more of an illusion. There's a debate going on there. But nonetheless, I think everyone would definitely agree with the fact that what we're experiencing is an extremely poor resolution reality versus what's actually out there.
Yeah. So Aldrich, in my book that I'm working on right now called Visionary Somatics, I go very, very deeply into the science of the cerebellum. Mm. And what I find is there's a big gap in the literature in regards to how the cerebellum is a central component of the default mode network. Mm. Okay. Now, the cerebellum has everything to do with feed forward. It has everything to do with predictive simulation, that we're, what are we simulating? We're simulating sequences, you know, from a muscular perspective, sensory motor perspective, and how, and you actually talk about the tickle response, which is perfect. This is a perfect image of what the cerebellum is doing and how to kind of circumvent this feed forward mechanism. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, it's next to impossible, if not impossible, to tickle ourselves. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, try it. So for you watchers and listeners out there, try to tickle yourself right now. Just try it and send in a message to Boundless Body if you can do it, because I'm really interested if you can do it.
And if you can, you should probably go to a physician, because there may be something off.
Exactly. So what's happening then is that when we attempt to self-tickle, what the cerebellum is doing is it's predicting the sensory motor components of where we're about to touch. It can actually accurately do that because it knows, and it can predict and project where those fingers are going to go and what the sensory feedback loops are going to be and what the motor feedback loops are going to be. Right. But when another person is going to tickle us, the cerebellum can't predict that. It can't project that. So there, it kind of leads to this disjointed processing. So I was laughing with my students the other day. I was like, you know, perhaps psychotherapy is a type of sublimated tickling. Because it's a way of circumventing the prediction system, right? And so it's like tickling that's not tickling, because obviously we would need consent for that. And we wouldn't want to literally tickle clients, although we could maybe make a case for how it could be clinically indicated.
Yeah, you know, a few more bits about the cerebellum, I think that'd be kind of interesting to see or to share with you, that you probably know, but maybe the audience doesn't. But, you know, most of the times when we think of, for example, the homunculus, the areas of your body that are represented in the neural real estate in your brain, most of the time people think of like the strip in your somatosensory cortex and the parietal lobe, or the motor cortex within the frontal lobe. But lots of people forget the fact that there's a homunculus in the cerebellum. In the cerebellum you could, if you look up cerebellum and homunculus, you'll find a bunch of little like elf looking creatures having a party in the cerebellum, which represent different parts of the body. And the other interesting research, I think that's coming out. Well, number one, you mentioned it being part of the DMN. That along with the thalamus has been being taken with more, I think, consideration. With the cerebellum, I think there's a 2019 paper that first came out with that was really focusing on that. But beyond that, the important part of the cerebellum, the idea that it's involved with balance, right? With fine motor coordination. Those are sort of the ordinary ways of thinking about it. But there is some more research coming out in relationship to the idea that it doesn't only do that from a sensory level, but also from that emotional level. So yeah. You know, not just sensory balance, but also emotional balance and such.
Yeah. So it's not only doing sensory motor sequencing and how we sequence our motor plans and movements and stuff like that. It's also sequencing socially. It's predicting and projecting social sequences. With trauma or even with really intense experiences, the cerebellum loses its capacity to sequence. You know, so, and I, the example that I like to give is when we're in the middle of a conflict or an argument or something, I like to ask, do you think, I do a little poll with students. I say, you know, when you're in the middle of an argument and things are getting intense and hot, how possible do you think it is to do some sewing? You know, and people laugh about that because they know that they're not going to be able to sequence the fine motor skills to be able to sew. And then also it's hard to string together the sequence of words and syllables and, you know, to string together the sequence of a sentence when intensity starts to really ramp up, right? It's like, It's, you know, it becomes disjointed, the sequencing.
Yeah. You know, there are a few ideas there. You know, one of the studies they've done is that put people who have, you know, basically social anxiety or speech terror inside of an fMRI, and they basically look at their brains to see what's happening. And what they find is that, you know, one of the areas of your brain that's involved with speech production, we call it Broca's area, it's in the frontal lobes. And so what happens is that instead of blood usually flowing to that region that allows you to express yourself and articulate, all that blood flow is actually being redirected to your limbic system, into your fight flight zones, and then it prevents you from able to speak articulately. The same thing is likely happening with the difficulties with activities that involve cerebellar modulation, right? Where blood flow is not actually occurring optimally, and they're all being redirected to other places that may be more important for sort of just global survival.
I'm so glad that we can geek out about the cerebellum together. It's awesome. I thought it was a really important gap in the literature, and I'm glad that the literature's gone in that direction to include and centralize the cerebellum as a component in the default mode network. And the other piece, you mentioned the thalamus, that's involving what Damasio called core consciousness, right? Like if you get a lesion in the thalamus, it's really, really bad news. Yeah.
No, well, it's a relay station. Almost everything goes through the thalamus except for olfaction. But yeah,
smell goes right to the amygdala. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other, piece that's central to the default mode network, which I found in some really recent literature, or at least that there's a recent framework, is the periaqueductal gray. And the periaqueductal gray is, as Panksepp would say, is grand central station of emotion, where you have the biggies. I like to call them the psychodramatic molecules. You know, the serotonins, the dopamines, the endogenous opioids, the enkephalins, the kind of, you know, like the biggies routed through there, and has something core to do with the powers of emotion. Mm-hmm. And you do reference the periaqueductal gray in reassembling models. Do you have anything to say about that core structure in the brain right close to the fluids there?
I mean, it's a very, very important region because, well, number one, you can have large areas of your cortex removed or damaged and still be conscious and still have emotions. You may be slightly different in different respects, but mostly you will be intact. But if you just have a 1 millimeter lesion on the PAG, you can be in a coma, you could be dead, right? And the other part is that it's in the midbrain, right? And when you think about the brainstem, midbrain regions, they're pretty much the most protected areas of the brain. So evolutionarily speaking, it's already highlighting the importance of these areas. What I think Pankset brought into the picture, well, he did a lot, but one of the major things is he completely inverted the dominant paradigm of emotions being cortically constructed by the cortex, that emotions, for example, may not have existed in other animals or whatnot that don't have a developed cortex. But what Pankset was showing through a lot of his studies was the fact that emotions are actually born all the way in the brainstem. And he goes even further, right? And says it's not even just emotions, but it's consciousness. And in fact, consciousness itself is a feeling. And then if you go to the work of Mark Solms, right, he will then say that, which by the way, I interviewed him recently. If you go to his work, you know, he says that, you know, when you perceive the world around you, you don't have to perceive the world consciously. We perceive lots of things unconsciously. And this goes back to Whitehead, actually, bridging that in, where Whitehead didn't believe everything is necessarily conscious, but it's experiential. You can experience things around you, but you can only be conscious of a certain spotlight. It's a certain figure amongst the wide background, right? It's only once you focus your attention do you become conscious of it. In any case, so if you add feeling to perception, then what arises is consciousness.
Brilliant. So what I'm thinking is that, or what I'm seeing is if we come back to the sailor ship, the periaqueductal gray would be on the mast, but lower. And it would be, if we imagine for a moment, like there's this wonderful series that I like, a TV series called The Magicians, because I like that magical stuff. And in The Magicians, there's a boat that's alive. Okay. And it actually talks and has feelings and stuff like that. And it, when it decides that it doesn't want to go somewhere, it'll go left or it'll go right or something like that. Okay. So let's use our imaginations for a bit and imagine that the ship is alive. And that at the base of the mast, that would be the periaqueductal gray. In the heart of the heart of the heart, in the brain, it's right close to the fluid midline. And the closer that we get to the fluids of the brain, the closer that we get to central neural structures that are central to processing and feeling and whatnot. So I'm imagining at the base of the ship is almost like a nuclear generator of some kind, kind of like the heart of the ship, right where the mast meets the kind of, I don't know, the heart of the ship or something like that. And when emotion starts to rise, because the periaqueductal gray is it's the big emotions, right? So the care system, that's the attachment system. The panic grief system, that's the separation distress system. You have the dopamine system, which Pankset calls the seeking system. You have the rage system, you know, you have the lust system, and then also the play system. And then, of course, there's fear. Nobody knows about fear, right? But Pankset was famous for, he was a lover of tickling as well. He tickled rats, right?
We've sold the rat tickler for a while, yeah.
So he was like a biggie for tickling. So he must have been a cerebellum lover too, even though he centered the periaqueductal gray. So what I'm seeing then is like this throbbing zone of emotional intensities at the base of the mast. And in PTSD, for example, those feelings just like swell up and pop the flashlight or the floodlight off of the top of the ship, you know, and that's what, and that clocks with the literature in terms of the periaqueductal gray being part of the default mode network, but at the root of it, and so it like pops the sailors off the ship, off the back of the ship or something like that. We have kind of a nuclear explosion.
Yeah. In neuroscience terms, you know, what is also included with the DMN is what they call the midline structures. It's sort of a synonymous name. There's slightly differences. But what you talk about when you bring in the PAG is part of a system they call the subcortical midline structures. And basically it's below cortex, obviously. And so all of these are acting together, right, in order to generate the experiences that we have.
Yeah, and I think I like to use that framework that these subcortical midline structures are, because there's this misconception out there that the amygdala is like Grand Central Station of fear, when it's probably more accurate, and it's convincingly accurate via Panksepp, that it's more close to the center, where the amygdalae are off to the side. And it's a common misconception that's talked about in somatics and trauma resolution theory that the amygdala somehow is the center of fear, where it's more accurate to say it's right in the midline.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely very important for fear. We definitely can't ignore that part. But it's fear is a system, and it's not necessarily, we can't just limit it to the amygdala. That's for sure.
Yeah, so Panksepp, yeah, let's just go there. Panksepp has his model of what he calls primary, secondary, and tertiary. Primary processes in the brain, which are centered around the periaqueductal gray and the subcortical structures at the base of the mast. Yeah. Secondary structures, which are included, the amygdala is included there, and have to do with learning. Mm-hmm. Processes of conditioning, processes of learning. So as soon as we add learning into the equation, complexity ramps up a significant amount, because we have conditioning. If you knock out the amygdala, it's going to be, you know, you're not going to be able to do much associative learning, but you'll still be able to feel fear, because that's, you know, the heart of that is a primary process. Tertiary is all this cortical matter that makes complex associations. Yeah. And default mode network is kind of like a narrative structure, eh?
Yeah. Let me just go back a little bit here. I would say one thing that's interesting to note, though, about the amygdala, because we do actually know what happens when amygdala is destroyed, right? There is something called the Kluver-Busey syndrome, for example. And actually, so they did these experiments with rats at first, where they destroyed the amygdala, poor rats. But they would have like a rat, they'd put it into a cage with a snake. And of course, at first, the rat would run to the corner. It's like, get me out of here, get me out of here. But the ones that, when they destroyed the amygdala, they had amygdala ablation, they put them in that cage with the snake. It actually goes up to the snake, and it's almost trying to play with the snake. And in humans with Kluver-Busey syndrome, there are a whole bunch of different symptoms. But one of them is actually a blunting of fear, and other things come along like hypersexuality and eating things that they should not be eating, we could say, and a whole bunch of other stuff. But just to throw that out.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The verdict might be a little bit more out on that than Panksepp imagined, that amygdala might be more core.
Well, I mean, it's like you think of it, it's like we have to think of the brain systemically. Right, I think is the important part, where it's like if one part of the system doesn't work, it's going to mess up the rest of them as well. Process mm-hmm. is just not going to be the same, right? And whether yeah. it's complete fear extinction, or just the blunting of fear, or a degree to which fear is gone, where they feel more playful towards something, right? Mm-hmm. Or they're less inhibitable. Like there are lots of things to consider. But what is important is that when you move into the systemic thinking process, it becomes easier to consider, yeah, the amygdala may not be perhaps the core area, because there are core areas, plural.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And that's I think at the heart of this new model, this paradigm shift into network neuroscience, where you have more, you know, less this model of modes, distinctive modes that are somewhat, you know, like quite differentiated, and you have more of a kind of nonlinear interconnected map. And I do have a quote from the book about interconnected systems that I'd love to read, because it's a good segue to wherever we're going. Okay, so here it is. The whole body may be best understood as an interconnected web of differentiated systems, with the mind an emergent phenomenon resulting from interactions from relationships within and between the individual and their environment. In interpersonal neurobiology, the mind is further conceptualized as a complex system that emerges from the brain, body, and relationships. So here we have this image of distributed systems. And really what I talk about in the book, and you definitely go there in yours, in my book, I'm talking about the infrastructure of the universe itself. A lot of writers have talked about that there's like a rhizome structure, that there's a network infrastructure in the universe itself that is kind of nonlinear and mycelial, and the brain does that too. It's an interconnected web. You have any comments about that?
I've never heard of that before. Maybe you can elaborate a little more so I get a better understanding of what you mean by that.
Yeah. So this is actually from astronomers and physicists. It's not, you know, kind of metaphysical mumbo jumbo. There's a principle called the cosmic web. And the cosmic web comes from the study of dark matter and dark energy. And what they've seen is that there is these microfilaments that can be seen as a kind of as a web-like structure, a nonlinear web-like structure that is the infrastructure of the universe itself. And it's quite interesting that they actually, in this cosmic web articulation, they explore a kind of fundamental pulsatile action within the infrastructure, a contractile and an expansive rhythm that they call tidal movements, which is really, and I do have a quote that I drew also from your work here, which dovetails with this quite nicely. It says, and this is on your discussion about Whitehead.
Okay.
We all inhabit fields of awareness that are perpetually expanding and contracting. They seem to expand in comfort, contract in moments of anger, dissociate from memory in deep sleep, and enter a reliable state in wakefulness. So we have this kind of interesting mapping. This comes from general systems theory, this mapping that, you know, as above, so below. In every system, you have general systems characteristics. And I think this is one of the things that is just so extraordinary. And, you know, from this general systems perspective, you have the really, really big, the universe, you have this rhizomatic infrastructure, you know, this nonlinear infrastructure that expands and contracts.
Right, right.
That's what consciousness does too, right?
Right.
It's what the body does.
Yeah, I mean, in that case, I have to look deeper into it, but does this also relate to fractal systems or fractal geometry in some?
I think so. And with fractals though, there's some, I do believe there's some sort of obsession with symmetry, almost like a prioritization of symmetry. Whereas the study of physics, you know, I talk about the study.
It's asymmetry though, with fractals. That's how it differs from traditional geometry.
I mean, that makes sense. But I think what I'm referring to is that how it shows up functionally in folks that get really, really into fractals. They seem to, there does seem to be this kind of equation of symmetry with perfection and with beauty and things of that, things like that. I like to talk about it as this is another piston
right
in the body and the universe, a piston between symmetry and anti-symmetry. You know, the physicists are obsessed with broken symmetry, right? And I think that it's more dynamic and mobile to think about there's some sort of fundamental piston in the universe that's doing symmetries and then breaking, symmetries and then breaking, symmetries and then breaking.
It's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah. So let's see here. And you do talk about symmetry and reassembling models as well. All sorts of wonderful stuff there. One argument, Aldrich says, against this idea is that asymmetry may help generate novel solutions. What the heck do you mean by that? That asymmetry might have something to do with novelty?
Well, I think we could explore this at multiple levels again. If things are perfectly balanced and symmetrical, no change really needs to be propelled into action. When things are asymmetrical, when there is an imbalance, the system strives for balance. And in order for a system to strive for balance, sometimes new learning is required, right? If we are unable to meet a goal and our homeostatic balance from an internally metabolic perspective is disrupted, well, we have to try and meet that goal. And to meet that goal, sometimes we have to learn new skills, right? And so whenever there's asymmetry involved, the system seems to continually be propelled towards the necessity for growth and potentially novelty on top of the growth.
I really loved your definition of concrescence, which is a fancy word in Whitehead.
Right.
That is, you know, it's mobile. It's hard to pin down, but I love how you define it. You call it, you say, the production of novel togetherness. Which in a way is what psychotherapy is.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
The production of novel togetherness, that gives me the tingle response. No. Your piece about transcendence is wonderful in reassembling models as well. You talk about things ranging from the experience of awe, Japanese forest bathing. Mm-hmm. And in my research, I ran into a lot of this, and I've talked about it, I think, on every episode now, but I'm going to continue to talk about it. The tingle response. It's underappreciated. It's underappreciated in the literature. It's underappreciated in discourse, in psychological discourse. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's talked about a whole lot more in spiritual traditions. But to me, when we're doing this, the production of novel togetherness, when it's actually happening, I feel like my body tingles more.
Yeah, that is a really interesting experience. Yeah, I'm the same way, actually. I haven't actually considered that response too seriously. But now that you bring it up, it seems to be an interesting perspective and perhaps very important for better understanding the uniqueness of humanity.
Mm-hmm. The technical term for it is called involuntary piloerection.
Mm.
And actually, it's kind of a misnomer because I ran into one research study that basically says that there's some people on planet Earth that can voluntarily give themselves the tingle response.
By the way, this is also in layman's term, goosebumps, right?
Goosebumps. Which is a layman.
Yeah.
Goosebumps, the tingle response, goosebumps. So this research article said that actually some people on planet Earth can actually voluntarily give themselves the goosebumps.
That's interesting. Yeah.
And in this article, they looked at the big five personality traits, which OCEAN is the acronym for the big five, right? So you have openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And what they found in the paper is that people, because they studied the tingle response, they studied it scientifically and did a lot of multidisciplinary research, and they found that people that experienced the tingle response more were high in openness. Cool. And were much more likely to experience transcendent states of awe. Mm. I just thought that was just wonderful. And I think also there's a section in your book that you talk about the strength of the absurd.
Yeah, that goes back to my existential interests, specifically Kierkegaard.
I think that's cool because sometimes, you know, sometimes one of these moments of the production of novel togetherness, when we're really in it, one way in, I think, to that is through absurdity. Mm. Like when we, you know, where the tightness and the rigidity of our default modes of processing just somehow just opens up. One way of opening that up, I think, is through absurdity.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Absurdity is definitely an opening to novel togetherness. I mean, it really allows for divergent thinking, right?
Yeah, Kierkegaard has this term called the Knights of Infinite Resignation, and which is a wonderful term. And he contrasts that with the strength of the absurd. So basically what he's saying is like really rigid, resigned, cynical types lack a connection with absurdity. I think that's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. That dimension of absurdity, I think, adds quite a bit to the experience and of reality and lends to us a more playful attitude. You know, when you start taking things too seriously and your life becomes very structured, it's actually unhealthy. You know, we have a play system, a play emotional system that's involved all the way into our brainstem, right? It's just endogenous to who we are. And part of play as adults is finding yourself in these sort of pockets of absurdity and getting into these existential frameworks of mind and playing with chaos to see what comes out.
Now, that's a slow pitch softball to me around chaos. I'm not going to swing, though, because that could take us into an existential soup that I want to go in, but probably in another discussion. We can maybe talk Deleuze or something like that. I'd like to take it back into the direction of the default mode network. So what I'm seeing here is that the default mode is a kind of, I haven't really thought about it this way before, but a type of symmetry. I was going in the direction of, it's a kind of narrative structure where when it's working well, narratives are sequenced quite well. Somebody that's has PTSD isn't going to be able to tell their story, tell their narrative in a coherent sequence often because that, you know, there's going to be intrusions and whatnot. But when it's kind of on hyperdrive, I'm thinking of it as almost a type of symmetry that resists being broken because everything just gets put into the narrative and then everything can end up being quite rigid. What do you think of that idea?
So you have to push back a little bit on this idea.
Yes.
Namely because the DMN is not a rigid network. We know that you can change your DMN. For the positive or for the negative. From the negative perspective, we might think of PTSD, right? Since we're already on that, where there may be amygdala intrusions during your DMN activity, where there may be alterations in salience network and DMN connectivity and such, right? So in a sense, if we think about what your default resting state network is, it's unchanged. And on the side, if you look at mindfulness studies, there have been some studies that found that individuals who engage in a fair amount of mindfulness, actually their dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, dorsal to the top, lateral to the sides, it's very involved with executive functions, becomes integrated into the DMN system, and that becomes their default network. And then on top of that, sorry, one more thing that's interesting about this mindfulness stuff is that when they look at the posterior cingulate cortex, the PCC in the back, which is very involved, by the way, with self-referential processing, your experience of self. One of the reports you get from people who meditate a fair amount is that they have less of an identification with themselves, right? And naturally they want to be or become more empathic. And what they find is that the posterior cingulate cortex is actually more silenced. There's less activity going on there in relationship to these increased reports. And so the DMN is a flexible, it's a malleable network when we speak of it, traditionally, we speak of the average, quote unquote, GMN, but, you know, but again, it is something that can change.
So how would you frame then somebody that has rigid beliefs from a neural perspective, from a neurobiological perspective? How would you frame somebody that has rigid belief structures and a rigid way of perceiving reality on a continual basis? How would you frame that neurobiologically?
I mean, so one area I would think of would be the basal ganglia. That might be involved, especially its relationships with obsessive compulsive disorder. You might think about rigid, quote unquote, rigid networks that corresponds from the cortex ground to being the limbic system. You could think about it also left hemisphere versus right hemisphere, with the left hemisphere bias over the right hemisphere. I mean, one of the ideas we know very well is the left hemisphere interpreter, which is, I think, constantly not misunderstood, but not given enough emphasis, because, you know, our left hemispheres, it creates narratives that it makes stuff up, right? In the studies that they've done in the olden days with Roger Sperry and his colleagues like Bogut and Gazzaniga, right, where they were testing split brain patients, just I'm giving some context for the audience sake, right? If you split the hemispheres in half, you can test each hemisphere to see how they perceive and conceive the world differently through different studies. If you present something to the right eye, it's going to go towards the left hemisphere and left eye towards the right. In any case, I'm not going to go deep into those studies, but what they find, right, is the very idea that the left hemisphere will make up responses and reasons behind why they viewed a particular item in a study. And why that's so important is just the very idea that for the majority of us, our left hemispheres are just creating narratives, explaining away things that we may experience but might have an uncertain conclusion, namely because the right hemisphere doesn't have the speech component to it, at least in the way of speech production. It might have the prosody and the context, the pragmatics associated with speech, but like areas homologous to the Broca's and Wernicke's, but overall the left hemisphere can come up with some narratives that can be quite rigid, we can say. So, you know, look at it from multiple perspectives. You can look at it from cortical down to subcortical. You can look at it from the DMN perspective, as you have, and which may also contribute, but we have to look at it from the multiple networks now. And also you can look at it from the left and the right hemisphere. So vertical, horizontal, perpendicular networks and such.
So how do you tickle all that stuff when it's rigid? Like, how do you do that clinically? Like, I guess one of the ways that we've agreed on is through absurdity.
Yeah. I mean, this is the purpose of psychotherapy, right? It's a big part of it, at least. And the way that you would conceptualize it from a cognitive perspective is an updating of memory systems, right? So someone comes in and they share their narrative with you, and their narrative is coming partially from their memory systems in relationship to all sorts of other systems. But when they bring it up, it's now in the almost present, we'll say, quote unquote, that's in the almost present. And in the almost present, you work with those narratives. And there are four core goals that we have here, right? And this comes really from my mentor's work, Lou Cozzolino. And so one of them is you want to induce mild to moderate levels of stress. So you want to challenge them. You can't just let them necessarily, well, some sessions, maybe venting is okay when you're building rapport, but you want to challenge some of those belief systems and maybe question the validity to them, right? Those are just examples. You can use many other different ways, but mild to moderate levels of stress is important. In the somatic perspective, maybe asking them to delve into some bodily sensations that may not be so comfortable, right? And at the same time, not have them flooded so that they're traumatized, but then you bring them back using different techniques to a safer place. So that might be another way. Secondly, you want to activate both cognition and emotion. So if someone's too intellectual, well, you bring in the emotions. If they're too emotional, well, you need to maybe bring in the intellect, right? Third, you want to obviously alter their narratives. Part of the importance of the therapist is to provide alternate perspectives and layer atop old narratives, new narratives, right? That can really update the system. And so, you know, and then the very first one that I missed is to provide them with a solid relationship and a safe environment, because that sets the context for neuroplasticity to happen. And so you put all four of those together, and you can use whatever theoretical orientation or techniques you want to. Those will optimize neuroplastic changes and hopefully update and reconsolidate some of those rigid belief systems so that they are but they're reconsolidated into the long-term networks with a different narrative. And every time you bring it up over and over again, let's say, and you keep finding new angles and you keep challenging them. And that's one of the benefits of having crappy memory, is that our memory systems are fallible, right? They're not that reliable, but they can change.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of folks don't know that, how changeable memories are, that when we access a memory, it changes each time and gets reconsolidated, is the technical term, right? When we light up a memory network, those neurons kind of become labile and open up. And it's one of the things with trauma regression work, right? You know, in order to get optimal stress, you make sure a person has enough resources, you know, to be able to access those neurons, access in the neural fabric there, so that the neurons are ready to be primed and then given a new experience, mm-hmm. you know, through these four pillars that you just shared, right? Given a new experience so that then it can be during the next sleeping cycle and during the reconsolidation process of the memory, it gets reconsolidated and changed together with something that's new, like the presence of the therapeutic relationship, the safety, the flexibility of the relationship. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You also talk about, so that, you know, that's great in terms of, okay, if there's some rigidities in terms of processing and perception. You also talk about cycling, a process called cycling, which is another way to loosen rigidities, I think, in this framework where cycling is kind of your version of Eugene Gendlin's work, yeah, the focusing work. It kind of embodied, kind of like, you know, Aldrich's somatic psychology. So I'm wondering, maybe I'll read this quote first, and then we can talk a little bit about cycling, and then I'd like to transition into discussion about work with mental imagery.
Sure.
Okay. So here we go, cycling. The intent of cycling is to actively elicit or cycle through responses from distributed networks throughout cortical and subcortical neural regions and the autonomic nervous system. And you use the acronym IC, which is image, sensation, emotion, and evolution. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, sure. So firstly, I start off with image, and this, so the technique, I would normally use it when people are, for example, stuck on an issue or a problem, but they don't really have the ability to articulate it, right? So in analytic words, it's called having a brain for
it. The archetype?
Oh, no, it's not an archetype. It's like it's an unknown known. That's what it is.
Ah, unknown known. That's nice. Yeah. I like
it. So it's called the unknown known. So it's like you kind of know it, you can feel it, you can experience it, but you're unable to articulate what's happening. So it's like, okay, well, what can we do? You can talk around it until you reach a conclusion, or we can access other faculties of your mind that may be closer to what that feeling or experience might be. Right. And so in my models, like I start off with sensation and emotion as being the most primitive, but then image comes afterwards. So instead of starting off with speech, which I know is so dominant in our culture, let's start off with image. Right. And so that's what the I would be. So you start off with asking them to, you know, comfortably sit back and basically relax and close their eyes and just let whatever image arises. And so this is accessing the default mode network. Right? Their mind wandering. and they're mind wandering, but it's sort of intentional in the sense that they're letting it wander around this experience or feeling. And when they arrive at the image, whatever it may be, and people usually always arrive at some image that represents what they're feeling, we already have a little more certainty, right? And so that's the I. Then you move into the sensations, and that's the S, right? And so with the sensations, what's going on in your body in this moment as you're holding this image in mind, right? And so, you know, maybe they're feeling some constriction around their heart, right? Maybe they're feeling some tightness. Maybe, you know, it can be anything. And you're just having them slowly explore these different sensations. And then eventually you move into emotion. And so we're really working on the three most, I would say, the primitive fundamental levers of human experience. And by going through them, you know, eventually what will happen, hopefully, is that that experience becomes digested into a way that it can be expressed symbolically through language. And so that's the evolution component, where after you go through the image, the sensations and the emotions, well, then we can move forward towards maybe revisiting the image to see if the image has changed, right? Because the no thing remains, according to Whitehead's ideas, everything is a becoming, right? So eventually this will inform the present, and something new might happen, which also typically happens. And then you can ask them and talk and bring in the verbal component of it all.
Brilliant. I really like that. And I like how it lines up with the sailor image and the triple network thing, and how we've been talking about cortical, subcortical. You have that default mode network, the engagement with narrative and kind of the waking dream. You have the salience network, the readout of the sensations. You have the subcortical structures lining up with the orientation to emotion. And you just really have this really whole picture, where I'm actually seeing something like, because it's an art, right? It's not like it's an art informed by science.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, it's unthought known. That's what it is.
Well, the unthought known.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. I think it's wonderful. So I'm seeing like something like the art of this type of cycling work or somatic psychology work. I'm seeing it as a kind of music on the ship that helps to integrate the sailors, you know, so that they're in creative, what did we call it? The novel togetherness, you know, where the music isn't such that the sailors on task that are working with fish hooks or whatever, don't focus on the music so much that they... that they get a fish hook in their finger or something like that, but a way that it kind of amplifies togetherness and creates a situation where more novelty can happen in terms of relatedness and meaning and togetherness and all of that stuff. So I just think that's so wonderful. Mm. Let's talk a little bit about mental imagery, because it's core to this model that you're talking about. Let's talk a little bit about the neurobiology of mental imagery, because, you know, first of all, mental imagery from my research does directly light up the periaqueductal gray and the autonomic system. Let's define for the audience the central autonomic system, the central autonomic network, which is another contender for a whole nother network, right? Which the periaqueductal gray is the core. But, you know, let's talk a little bit about mental imagery and the autonomic nervous system, maybe define the autonomics and talk about how mental imagery can light up the autonomic system.
Sure. I mean, so the first of all, the autonomic system, when I think of autonomic, you should think of the word automatic. It's about controlling involuntary systems. And so the autonomic system composes of the sympathetic system and the parasympathetic system, which I think most people have heard of. The sympathetic system is all about, you know, fight, flight, preparing your body for action. And then you could say that the parasympathetic system is about rest and digest, or conserving and maintaining energy. I always ask my students, like, if they know Spanish, because parar means to stop in Spanish. So it's like the stop sympathetic nervous system. It's also kind of a funny way to think of it. But in any case, you know, you have these two systems. And they're very, very connected to subcortical regions. If we, because obviously if we perceive threat, well, it's going to trigger the sympathetic system and prepare your body for whatever needs to happen. Now, let's go to imagery. Now, imagery begins higher up in the brain, right? So when we perceive an experience or have an experience, the thought is that we have occipital lobe activation, right? The visual cortex, and information is fed upwards towards the parietal lobe. And we call this the where pathway. It helps us identify where objects are, for example. Okay. And then there's also another important passageway we call the what pathway. The occipital lobes send information to the temporal, the ventral regions of the temporal lobe, the inferior regions, and we call that the what pathway. It helps us identify what an object is. Now, I say this because when we think of imagery, it's inverted, right? So basically now the main area that starts with activation is going to be your parietal regions, particularly an area called the precuneus, and that's going to send information down to the opposite side, down to the occipital lobe, and allow you to visualize an experience. Now, all of these systems, as you well know, Brian, are connected from the cortical down to the subcortical. The precuneus in particular, for example, has several neural highways, we can say, that's connecting to it from areas of the subcortical regions.
Precuneus is music to my ears, Aldrich. I go into the precuneus at length in my book. It's part of the default mode network. It lights up during mental imagery. It is a structure. It's a primary structure involved in the efficacy of PTSD treatment. So essentially, the articles that I've seen have said, if the cerebellum and the precuneus do not light up, trauma is essentially less likely to be resolved. Mm. Mental imagery is directly impacts the precuneus. Both of these structures, the precuneus and the cerebellum, are wired to the periaqueductal gray. And the periaqueductal gray, you know, for example, I ran into this article that when a person is visualizing an athletic event, it's done so with thick description. We'll come back to thick description because I have a quote from your book around thick description. It's done with nuanced and detailed description that the periaqueductal gray and its influence on heart rate and so on will get activated at about 50% of the same level that's activated when the person is actually engaged in the exercise. Mm. So there we have a direct, you know, scientific correlation with mental imagery.
Yep.
The mental image up top has a direct influence not only on the close to the mid core structures, but on the midline and the midline structures of the brain, which is extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, if we bring this even more concretely, just to the phenomenological level, I mean, if we think about what brings anxiety to lots of people this day and age, the images that they have in their minds and the thoughts that come with them, right? If someone, you know, is in a, you know, in, I don't know, walking into a dark abandoned building, right? Let's say there's no one there, but it's dark and abandoned. Most of us are going to feel a little scared. And that scariness might come from the imagined monsters that have arisen in our minds. And that's going to trigger our autonomic systems directly, right? Like it's a completely experiential. It's very, very salient of an experience when that sort of thing happens. I think it's really fun to have all this grounded in the neuroscience, but sometimes it's just kind of like, well, okay, there's such a direct one-to-one correspondence with experience that it's like not that surprising, right?
Yeah.
So I'll leave it at that.
Well, it's good. I mean, it's good to come back to common sense that and people want this framework. A lot of folks, because I live in Silicon Valley, right? So I work with a lot of rationalists. And it can be really useful to have both the scientific frameworks and the common sense frameworks to kind of get people on board for mental imagery work, because it needs framing. Like, people need frames, because, you know, a lot of people just think, oh, mental imagery is like pie in the sky. Mm-hmm. Or like just some little ditty of the imagination that isn't going to have concrete results. Mm-hmm. So I think it's good to,
No, I was going to say, I mean, you could, there are lots of, I think, routes for challenging that sort of idea, right? I mean, where do lots of the most amazing genius ideas, where have they come from? They've come from mental imagery. Einstein actually donated his brain to science. Which part of his brain was most developed and actually special? Wasn't the frontal lobes, like some people thought, with the parietal lobes. It had a lot more to do with visual spatial perception and imagination, right? Maybe the clients that are in your sessions, right? Most of their anxieties are probably not real life threats. I don't know who you work with, but you said Silicon Valley. But a lot of them might be more imagined threats, right? So it's like, you're telling me that you don't think imagination or mental imagery is real, yet you're freaked out about your boss being on your ass this entire time about X, Y, or Z, right? And so it's very interesting to consider. Imagination has really helped us create all sorts of wonderful technologies and novelties and all sorts of things, but it also brings us this whole new dimension where we can freak ourselves out and develop complete disorders as a result.
Yeah. I see a lot of productivity anxiety. Mm. You know, just a lot of perseveration about, a lot of worrying about productivity, a lot of just, you know, default mode network spinning about productivity and projecting and predicting what isn't or could be, you know, productive or what was or wasn't productive.
That's all imagination, mostly what you're describing right now, right? So
mental time travel. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. Like, mental time travel sounds abstract or something, but we're doing it all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, we're doing it all the time. That's what I like about this neurobiologically informed mental imagery work is that we are doing what the brain does. We're just doing it intentionally. You know, we're getting in there with the memory. And then, so I promised we'd talk about thick description because I believe it to be central to the work that you're describing here. And here's your quote about that here. Actually, this, it comes from a student paper. As I said, your text is one of my assigned texts at university. And this comes from a student paper quoting you. Here's the quote from the student. Aldrich Chan deepens this to include the importance of vividness, or the process of thickening imaginal descriptions. Here's what he says. The thicker the description, the more likely you'll be doing integrative work.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Yeah.
What's thick description and why is it important?
Well, I don't think I've used that word. That's probably your student's word.
Oh, shoot. Maybe they're confusing Aldrich's work and Dr. Tierney's work. But the point is that, because you do that, right? I'm just focusing on getting those parietal lobes lit up, which is what you're doing too. Mm-hmm. You get the image dialed, and it's very it needs to be very spatial to get those parietal lobes lit up, and the hippocampus, it's very spatial, right? You go at length into the hippocampus, very, very concrete spatially. So when I'm doing work and doing scene construction work, you know, constructing a scene involves getting those parietal lobes and the procuneus lit up and really setting the scene with thick description, nuance, detail, and so on, to really get the brain primed for the memory work, or for the imagery.
I agree with everything that you said there. So, you know, I don't think I've described it as such, but maybe I did. Like I said, I don't remember half the stuff that I've written in that book. But you know, nonetheless, it makes sense. I mean, a large part of what we're doing as we are describe and articulate is really the conversion of, we can say, undigested, unmetabolized experiences into something that can be metabolized and something that can be experienced at multiple levels as opposed to just one.
Awesome. Well, there's so much more here. You know, I wanted to move into a little bit of a discussion about multiculturalism, but we'll table that and bookmark that maybe for a future discussion. I just think it's quite wonderful. And maybe we can kind of end with some sort of bow to that, that there's a multicultural complexity that's going to be in the treatment room, you know, and that, you know, there's a lot of rich traditions in terms of imagery and ritual practice, and the whole field of anthropology articulates just this enormously rich database of human imagery that can be just extraordinarily resourceful for a lot of people. And I just wanted to, because this is also celebrates the question, which is, you know, this podcast is really built in relationship with Spinoza's great question, what can a body do? What can a body do? Boundless Body is really wanting to ask that question and to not answer it too quickly, but to be in the mystery together, to be in the novelty together. And there's some alliteration with bees here. So I picked up a piece that you wrote in the book about African-centered psychology from Piper Mandy. Which you throw down a bunch of Piper Mandy throws down a bunch of bees here, which connects quite well with the boundless body and this question, what can a body do? Okay. And so they call it the path of spirit, the path of spirit, identifying seven cycles having to do with bees. Okay. Before, beginning, belonging, being, becoming, beholding, and beyond, right? That's just, I love that. I mean, those B words really nail it.
Yeah, I remember this is Piper Mandy and Rowe, right? Yeah. It's wonderful how many different perspectives and different, that different cultures bring to the picture. And it's a bit of a travesty that there's so much globalization and westernization that's wiping out essentially all sorts of other cultures out there. So it's, I think it's so important for us to preserve some of these ideas and share them in ways that can be useful and applicable.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Aldrich, for this this exploration in novel togetherness.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the invitation.
I hope we can meet again sometime, and blessings on your newly born child. And on your good work in the world.
Thank you for listening to The Boundless Body with the Somatic Doctor. Please leave a comment, subscribe, and like us on social media.
We're a swarm. We're a colony. We're a multiplicity.
Until next time, be well.